I remember once I was having breakfast with some friends, and there was a teenager. This was about that time. It was like 2015 or so. And I said to him, "How old are you?" And he said, "I'm 17, but I'll be 18 before the election." And I said, "Oh," I got all bright and happy. I said, "Oh, then you can vote." And there was like total silence at the table. And then later, the dad said to me, "We don't vote." And I said, "Why don't you vote?" And he said, "Well, you know, so often there's just like, you know, just a marginal difference between the candidates." And I said to him, "You know, a lot of people live in those margins. You know, there are a lot of people for whom a small change in, you know, minimum wage, for example, or something like that makes a big, big difference. A lot of people live in those margins. But if you have that sense of connection to others, even if their life doesn't look exactly like yours, you are moved by a sense of responsiveness. Like, oh, I want to see their lives getting better too."
This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully. Hey there, my fellow like-hearted humans. It's Michael, and this is the Kintsugi Podcast. I'm not sure if you've heard, but there is an election coming up. In fact, in 64 countries representing 49% of the world's population. Crazy, right? The pundits say this is the most important election ever. And I don't know if that's the case or not. But I do know this. Elections, especially the ones over the last few years, have a way of pulling us apart instead of helping us find a way to come together in our Kintsugi spirit. So how do we make it through this election season without losing ourselves or losing each other? How do we avoid doom scrolling, binging on cable news, pointing the finger at the other, grabbing a few more glasses of wine, or just turning everything off because we have the privilege to do so? How do we do that? Well, this week's guest is one of the perfect teachers for us. In fact, she's one of my teachers. Loving kindness, or metta, as a meditative practice, is one of the cornerstones here at Pause, Breathe, Reflect. It was essential to my recovery from my near-death cycling crash. And we practice it to this day, almost every day. And we do a live practice every Friday so we can put a beautiful ripple into the world as we begin the weekend. Sharon brings wisdom to this moment in time as one of the pioneers of meditation and mindfulness here in America. She has the experience to help us navigate this moment so we can remain hopeful about creating a more perfect union. And coming up at the end of September and the beginning of October, she has a 3-part series that is built foundationally on the 4 immeasurables: loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy or mudita, and equanimity. And in our conversation, we talk about this course, her beginnings, and how we can navigate this period of time in such a way that it brings out the best in us, that it puts a beautiful ripple into the world that can help future generations. So if you're ready, let's take a healthy breath in and a slow releasing breath out. And get ready to hear the wisdom from Sharon Salzberg on how we can participate in this election season in such a way where we become better together. Sharon, so good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So I want to begin here. You don't know this, but you have influenced my life in so many ways. And I can feel myself getting goosebumpy and almost choking up as I say this. We've never met in person, for those listening. I was close
to IMS a few weeks ago. I was in Deerfield, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. for a little bicycle race in the western part of Mass and in New Hampshire. And through my recovery from my big moment, loving kindness and your teachings were immeasurable, which we'll get into, for me and my recovery. So from the deepest part of my heart, I want to start here. I just want to thank you for doing the work you're doing and helping us see that there is a different path we can take besides violence, hate, and war. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's really beautiful.
Yeah. So I want to start, I want to bring us back to Western New York. So for those that don't know you, so I'm a Western New York kid, grew up in Rochester, as I mentioned. So you went to SUNY Buffalo.
I did.
Which a lot of my friends did. So it's 1969, and you take an Asian philosophy class, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the spark that got you into, you know, your current calling and your current work. So can you bring us back to that moment? Like, what compelled you to take that course? Was it part of the core curriculum, or was it an elective? Curious minds want to know.
Sure. So there was a philosophy requirement. And in all honesty, as far as I remember, I looked at that schedule and I thought, oh, that's like on Tuesday. That's convenient. You know, I'll do that one. And so I chose it, and the course actually did really literally change my life. So there were a couple of reasons for that. One was in the section where they're talking about Buddhism, they talked about the Buddha's very unafraid, unashamed acknowledgement of the suffering in life. And for a lot of people, that's kind of a depressing message, you know. But for me, as, you know, many know from my writings and speaking, you know, I had a very traumatic childhood, a very chaotic childhood, a lot of loss, a lot of change. And like many people also know from my writing, that my family system was the kind where this was just never spoken about. So I had all of these feelings inside of me, and I didn't know what to do with them. And here was this kind of external acknowledgement. There's suffering in life. This is natural. This, everybody, to one degree or another, will go through this. And rather than being a depressing message, for me, it was like so inclusive. It was like the first time I thought, I'm not so weird. I'm not so like kind of left out and different, and I belong, in effect. So that was huge for me. And then in the context of that class, I heard there were practices, there were methods called meditation, and if you practice them, you could actually be a lot happier. So I looked around Buffalo, New York, and I just couldn't find it anywhere. You know, and so in one of the miracles of my life, truly a miracle, I created an independent study project for the university, and I said, I want to go to India and study meditation. And they said yes. So I was like, I was 18 years old when I left. I was really a frightened person, a very timid person. I'd never even been to California before, you know. And then I thought, I'm going to go to India. And I thought, oh my God, looking back, I think, that was crazy, you know, like, what was I thinking? But something caught on fire, and it was such an interesting moment, because instead of thinking, maybe it'll work for other people, I'm left out, I'm on the margins, I don't count, I thought, I'm going to go right into the center of possibility and see what can happen for me. And off I went.
Wow. So brave, and so, like, so courageous to not be a traveler growing up. And I can so appreciate that. Like, I didn't travel at all growing up. Like, I went to Canada. But back then, you could go to Canada basically in the back seat of your parents' car and get across right. With a driver's license. There was no passport required. So I didn't do much traveling until I actually got married. So when I got married, my wife had to add pages to her passport, and I had to get one. She was a traveler, and I wasn't. So through that experience. So when you were there, so you didn't meet, say, Jack Kornfield.
I didn't meet Jack there. I met Joseph there.
Joseph there. Okay. Yeah. So was he also going to Buffalo, or was he part of another independent study?
Well, there were a few people who on their own had gone to India. I met Jack a little later. Well, Joseph and I met in India. Jack was having a parallel life in Thailand. There were a number of people who, interestingly enough, like Joseph and Jack, who'd been in the Peace Corps and were somehow assigned to Asia in different places and stayed on, you know, to study. There were a number of people at my very first retreat. It was January 1971. I met Joseph. I met Ram Dass, who was there as a student of spiritual things. I met many people who are still my very close friends and were kind of notable in the evolution of people's interests, like Dan Goleman, for example. Many, many years later, the author of Emotional Intelligence was the person who told me about that retreat. I met him in 1970, the end of 1970 in New Delhi. And of course, remember, this is before computers, this is before cell phones. Everything was word of mouth. Like Dan, you know, Dan said, I heard about a retreat I'm going to, where the presentation is very much about the practice. It's a very practical how to do this stuff. Doesn't involve really adopting a belief system. And I thought, oh, that's what I want. And that's how I went. That's how I ended up in the retreat. Joseph was already there. He'd been there for a few years following his time in the Peace Corps in Thailand. He'd gone to India to find a teacher. And we all just met up. It was like this amazing community that just developed quite spontaneously.
Isn't it wild how sometimes, call it the universe or higher power, what have you, has a way of bringing just the right people that you need to be in contact with together at the right moment. It's just, it's really, your story and their story is really insane when you think about it. So do you look at that time period, you know, this is late 60s, of course.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Early 70s, so you have a period of time in the late 60s in the States, and so we want to get into the program you're doing around the election. But that period of time for the United States, there was a high level of intensity and turmoil and protests and riots and unrest and all the other words that we can use. In a lot of ways, it parallels, not perfectly, but in some ways, what we're going through now. And for those that may have been born a little bit, later than like the late 60s, I was hoping you could share a little bit more about how you saw that time. You know, here you are as a idealistic college student, perhaps searching, and now you have more wisdom. How do you see both time periods? You know, is history repeating itself? Is it different from your perspective? How do you see it?
I think there are a lot of similarities, you know, which is a topic that intrigues me quite a lot. I keep hoping someone's going to write a book about that period and that wave of people who went off to Asia. You know, I don't think it's my book necessarily to write, but a journalist, you know, or historian or somebody. So the Vietnam War was going on. In fact, there were people also in those retreats in India and Thailand who were soldiers, you know, had been soldiers and stayed on. There was a draft. There were a lot of protests. I went back to Buffalo a few years ago, I guess now 4 years ago before the pandemic. And because now they have, you know, I couldn't find anything. Now they have a big mindfulness program. So I was invited back as a speaker, you know, it was like kind of outrageous. But my friend who still lives there, who'd gone to law school there on the campus, he drove me around. We did a little tour and I said, oh, I remember protesting there and being tear gassed. And he'd say, oh, I remember protesting there and being tear gassed, you know. And I think it was a tumultuous time. It was also, for a lot of people, the introduction of Eastern practices, the music and a little bit meditation, although maybe not, you know, so many practical instruction in those days, but somewhat, you know, it was just like in the air. So it's a really fascinating time. I think we thought we were going to change the world, and I think we did change the world, you know. Could use a little more change. You know, so.
Absolutely. I'm right there with you. But I want to commend you for the change that you all made and have created and continue to create.
Okay, I have to tell you my great claim to fame in hippiedom is I was at Woodstock. I was at the original Woodstock.
Nice.
Yes. I just wanted to throw that in.
So is there a memory from Woodstock that is most vivid for you?
I remember being fed by the hog farm, you know, by Wavy Gravy, and being really wet and sleeping in the mud.
Absolutely. But, you know. Oh, that's awesome. That's so great.
Yes.
So you have your hippie credentials by
thank you.
Being at Woodstock. No one, Sharon, can take that away from you. That is awesome. That is so good. Do you all get together, not to bask in your own ego, but do you come together in reunion and talk about those days, that time, and how you all see the world differently? I know you probably have communion and community at IMS, but do you give yourself time to reflect back on like all that has happened?
I think, well, there's still very, very strong bonds of friendship.
Sure.
You know, between many of us, and we do, you know, like, I find it fascinating, you know, I don't know anybody that looks back at that time and thinks, God, we were stupid, you know, like, what a waste. I should have, you know, had a job, you know, earlier, you know. I mean, ultimately, people needed to work, you know, or they're raising families, or there's a different level of responsibility. But, you know, I mean, it was the most precious, amazing time. And it was also an interesting time in terms of facing adversity, you know, because conditions, physical conditions, certainly weren't easy, and health and, you know, so many things were difficult. But that quality of learning, you know, and, you know, learning so much about oneself and discovery and forming friendships that lasted, you know, they've still are here 50 years later, you know, and kind of like finding one another. And it was so beautiful, and that we had a quality of resource in meeting the adversity that I think is a real lesson also.
Oh, I think so. I think through today's lens, you would be labeled as a group that had a failure to launch, which is a term I've come to understand is a thing nowadays when it comes to college kids, you know, the failure to launch into their professional lives.
I didn't know.
Yeah, so there's a thing. I think it hinders boys more than girls or men more than women. But yeah, this whole, like, how do you leave university or college and get into getting your job, basically, and making a living. And in some ways, once that happens, I'll say this from my own personal experience, once that happens, it almost shuts off the whole curiosity about learning about oneself and learning about the world, because you got a job to do. You got to get after it and do that thing that people do in corporate life. Yeah, so you would have been back then, if this was a term, Sharon, I think the lot of you would have been labeled as, oh, here's a bunch of kids. There's a failure to launch here, and this is a problem, as opposed to this wonderful exploration of discovery, which has, in so many ways, changed the world. And really, you all have really brought this Eastern philosophy to the States. And, you know, without you going, maybe the University of Buffalo doesn't have the type of mindfulness program it has today. It still might have one, but no doubt your fingerprints are on it in some form or fashion. So
yeah, thank you.
So I want to take us to 2016. So as we get into the election, so I know on YouTube you put out a loving kindness practice, I believe. It was a loving kindness practice post-election. So that was a difficult moment for us as a country, at least for some of the country. I don't think the country is really divided. I think we're sort of in thirds of, like, you know, this team, that team, and I don't think I have a team. So as opposed to this 50-50 divide. But going through the last, say, 8 years and coming up to this election cycle, what have you discovered about us, maybe about yourself, through these last 8 years, plus or minus a few days?
Well, I think it's on different levels. One is I've always been a very, very strong, passionate proponent of voting, of being engaged, you know, being involved. And I was surprised at meeting people who did not agree with me about that.
Fancy that, right?
You know, like, how could that be? You know, I think it's our voice, it's our chance, and everyone is equal, you know, like, it doesn't matter how much money you have one vote. And I think it's outrageous, you know, efforts to curtail people's ability or right to vote. And so I've tried to engage in that way and try to encourage people to vote, you know, to be a part of what's happening. And I was very surprised in the beginning at the resistance that I met, you know, because I'm not telling people who to vote for.
Sure.
For example.
Absolutely. You know, just vote.
Vote. You know,
get out there, be engaged, vote. Be active. Yeah.
That's right. And then, you know, because of my mindfulness practice, because of all these years of both looking within, and I think one of the things that happens in meditation that's a little bit quieter, you know, that people don't often think about is, and it's odd, you know, it's like meditation may be something you do all alone, it may be something you do with your eyes closed, but what happens is this tremendous and genuine sense of connection to others gets developed. And it's not forced or, you know, phony. It happens. And so I remember once I was having breakfast with some friends and there was a teenager. This was about that time. It was like 2015 or so or somewhere. And I said to him, "How old are you?" And he said, "I'm 17, but I'll be 18 before the election." And I said, "Oh," I got all bright and happy. I said, "Oh, then you can vote." And there was like total silence at the table. And then later, the dad said to me, "We don't vote." And I said, "Why don't you vote?" And he said, "Well, you know, so often there's just like, you know, just a marginal difference between the candidates." And I said to him, you know, a lot of people live in those margins. You know, there are a lot of people for whom a small change in, you know, minimum wage, for example, sure, or something like that makes a big, big difference. A lot of people live in those margins. But if you have that sense of connection to others, even if their life doesn't look exactly like yours, you are moved by a sense of responsiveness. Like, oh, I want to see their lives getting better too, you know? That's something that I would really like to have happen. And you may have, again, different views about how to accomplish that, but that basic sense of connection, that fundamental sense of connection can be very, very strong. And so now I'm proud to say they vote all the time, you know, so.
That's good. You converted the whole family. That's awesome. To voters. I had that whole notion that you're really voting for all of us.
Yeah.
As opposed to just voting for yourself. And, you know, living here in New Jersey, I come across many people who tell me, well, I'm not voting. Like, you know, these two candidates, at whatever level of the political ladder we happen to look at, neither one of them really appeals to me. And by the way, my vote doesn't matter anyway. We live in a blue state, right? That's sort of how the conversation goes. So I don't need to vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to put out the effort to vote. And I do think, like, our history as a country, so I know in your practice and your teachings and others, we talk about worthiness, you know, or enoughness. And we have such a history as it ties back to the ability, the power to vote, that you're not enough. You're not worthy enough to vote.
That's right.
Right. And so when we think about the generational trauma or limiting beliefs, we can look at the vote as an example of, like, that's real.
Yeah.
You know, we started the country off as with this notion that only certain people are allowed to vote. Only certain people are worthy of voting. And we had to fight for it.
Yeah.
And then to allow everyone to vote. And then we end up not voting. It's almost a disservice to everyone's voice, including our own. You know, we rob it when we don't vote.
So yeah, definitely.
I love that notion. So I want to now bring us to 2024. We have an election coming up, as we all know, on many fronts. And in fact, I think there are 63 other countries on this big blue marble that we share that have elections this year. I think it represents 49% of the world's population, which is crazy.
Yeah.
So I totally get why so many people have claimed this is the most important election in history. And I don't know if that's the case or not, and I'm not a historian to weigh on that. I know it's important. Every election's important. Mm-hmm. It's a chance to exercise our voice. And you have a series coming up, and I want to talk through the series a bit because it's all sort of couched or foundationally in the four immeasurables. So to ground us in those, can you share a little bit about each one? So if folks are not familiar with them, we can at least have that at least familiar ground. And then I would love to get into which, how the series sort of unfolds and how we can use it to help us navigate this period of time that we all face really across the planet, not just here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I learned that the four measurables as a teaching is a perspective I learned within the context of the Buddhist teaching, but I think you can really see it as kind of universal principles, you know, found in many places. So the first of them is loving kindness, which is a little bit of an odd term. You know, I've had translators and scholars say to me, just say love, you mean love, you know, but that's a complicated notion too. Like, what do we mean when we say
love? But sometimes people are like, I don't know. I don't want to go there. Right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We add kindness in as a way to go through the back door sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it really means it's not even necessarily an emotional state at all. It doesn't mean you like somebody, but it's a profound knowledge that our lives are connected. You know, that we actually live in a universe of interconnection, like it or not. It's like, sometimes I go into an organization or a company to teach, and my favorite question is, how many other people need to be doing their job well for you to do your job well? You know, sometimes that it doesn't resonate with people. So I say, okay, do you commute to work? Do you ever think about that auto mechanic or the, you know, train engineer? And if you don't commute, you ever think about that tech company, you know, or and that sometimes that doesn't work either. And I say, did you eat today? And if you don't grow all your own food, you know, we are living in an interdependent universe. And so loving kindness is really a very, it's like a bone deep acknowledgement that that is the nature of things, that that's what's true. Compassion is like a companion. It's the second of the four immeasurables. It's like a companion quality. It's almost like that same sense of connection, but based on realizing how, while we all suffer in different degrees or in different amounts, we're all vulnerable to change and insecurity and to loss. And so it's a sense of connection to others based on that vulnerability. So it's a caring. It's like our hearts are moved in the face of suffering. instead of feeling this has nothing to do with me, you know. Or, the third quality is called sympathetic joy, and that is literally or classically, it's taking joy or having happiness in the happiness of others, instead of feeling so jealous or envious, like you got it and I deserved it, and you know. We actually can feel happy for others' happiness. And that is based on many things, including spending a little time being grateful for what we have, you know, because if we feel we have nothing and we look at someone else's success, of course we're going to feel bad about it. But just spending a few moments saying, yeah, you know, it's not actually nothing, you know.
We have a lot. We have a lot and we can practice gratitude and still be thirsty for something additional in our lives.
That's right. But we don't feel that kind of resentment.
Yeah. Yeah. Others, and the comparison that's just really the thief of joy, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. And then the fourth quality after loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy is equanimity, which is an odd term. I always used to, you know, for so many of us, it sounds like indifference or coldness or not caring, which it really does not mean. My first teacher in that first retreat in January of 1971 was S.N. Goenka. And he used to go around all the time saying, be equanimous, be equanimous, be equanimous. And we used to whisper to one another, is that a word? Like, what does that mean? I don't know what that means, you know? It doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean coldness. It really means balance. And it's the balance born of wisdom. It's like, I want to seek change and I'll do everything I can. And I'm not in control of the universe. You know, I'm not, say, moving on my friend in this really terrible situation with the notion that I'm in control. I'm going to save them, you know. We do everything we can, and we can have a kind of balance, realizing things can take time.
Yes.
And as we plant seeds, we don't see the immediate results and things like that. So the wisdom factor never hurts the compassion factor. We think it does. It's going to cut it off, but it actually only helps. So those are the four boundless states.
A little funny story about equanimity. So as someone who has a total knee replacement, one of my good friends would often say to me, this happened a few years ago when I got it, he's like, you now have equanimous knee. So when I think of equanimity, I think of equanimous knee, K-N-E-E. So for all joint replacement people with a knee, that's a different definition of it. So
somebody just sent me a sticker as a present. Somebody I don't know sent me a sticker they had made with a picture of a moose, and it says equanimous.
Economist. I love it. That's a great sticker. That's a great sticker.
All right. Now feels like a good time to take a moment to pause, breathe, reflect. And when we come back, Sharon and I will talk about anger and how it's not necessarily the fuel we think it is. And she'll talk further about her election series and how you can join her in putting a beautiful ripple into the world. All right. Wherever you happen to be, come into a comfortable position. You can close your eyes if you like. Of course, if you're driving, please leave them open. And we'll take three simple breaths together. So let's drop in. Breathe up fully through your nose if you can. And begin to notice where you feel the breath most clearly. And now release the breath. Give yourself permission to relax into this moment. And let's take two more. Full breath in. And a nice releasing breath out. Now one more. A nice full breath in. And a releasing breath out. All right, nice job. You just did a simple pause, breathe, reflect break. And you can find hundreds of other short practices that can help you bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments on our app. They can help you let go of some stress, open your awareness, sharpen your focus, and meet your moment with equanimity. So you can be happier and ripple happiness to other people. Downloading the app is easy. All you have to do is go to Apple's App Store or Google Play and simply type in pause, breathe, reflect. And there you have it. You'll become a member of our like-hearted community of humans looking to be better humans to other humans. Now, let's go back to our conversation and talk about anger and Sharon series all around the election.
So the first series, you've heard the first part in the three-part series, you're focusing in on loving kindness and compassion. And I know you've heard this question before, but I still receive it because I do a loving kindness practice every day and lead one every Friday with a group. So when you see so much injustice in the world, and we've seen it happen, you know, since 69 when you were a college student, it brings up anger. And anger is energy, it's fuel, but it's not necessarily a clean burning fuel or a long lasting fuel. But you see things happening in the world. You can point to Ukraine. You can point to what's happening in Gaza. And I think a natural tendency for people is like, no, we gotta fight that. We can't do this loving kindness thing. It seems too soft and too slow. We need war. And I would love for you to just spend a few minutes here, just giving us an idea of like how loving kindness can fit in, and just that whole notion that we need to fight, because love is fierce. Like what we're talking about is coming from a different place. Mm-hmm. So from a loving place where we put the energy of love into the action we want to take, which is really coming from your book, Real Change. Mm-hmm. And just the power of that, because that's a cleaner burning fuel, if you know, from my perspective. And I would love for you to share a little bit more about that.
Sure. I mean, I think that is the common controversy, you could say, that we hear a word like love or loving kindness, and we think of it as sentimentality or something gooey, or certainly something submissive, you know, and kind of pretty and not very strong. But I think the actual experience of loving kindness is very, very powerful. And we see it, you know, in so many movements, really, you know. And, you know, in terms of the Buddhist framework, like, you could look at a model of action. There's different elements to an action. There's the motivation or the intention behind the action. There's the skillfulness of the action, which is very contextual. Like, you know, I may out of a... Well, let's start with motivation. I might decide to give you something, and all somebody sees is my hand moving down and picking up an object and moving it forward. But what's the heart space that's determining my hand going down? You know, am I offering it to you because I like you and I want you to have it? Am I offering it to you because I see you have this other thing and I think, well, hey, you know, maybe I'll give you this and you'll give me that in exchange, you know? Or am I offering it to you because I don't like you and I think it'll really drive you crazy, whatever it is, you know? But it's the same smile. It's the same gesture. It's that intentionality that's going to be really making it distinguished, you know, or different. And then there's the skillfulness of the action, you know? Like, we look at context. We sort of pay attention to mindfulness. We have discernment. You know, do I give you this object by hurling it across the room? Do I think, well, there are 15 people in this room, I've only got one cup, you know, maybe I'll give it privately, or I'll say it in this way. And those are different. you know, and this is the place where, you know, you talked about kind of fierce love. We might have a genuine motivation of love or compassion, and our discernment, our best guess of what's most appropriate in a particular situation is a strong boundary. It's being fierce. It's saying no. It's calling for change really intensely, you know, whatever it is. And they coexist, you know. The strength of the action doesn't mean we're coming from a place of hatred, yeah. You know. But we have to look. Where are we coming from? What's motivating us? Because I think it's exactly like you said. We can act, and we do act out of outrage, and but it tends, first of all, it tends to be self-destructive. You know, the anger itself eats us up.
Yes.
In the end, and so we kind of, that effort collapses because we can't sustain it. And I'm not talking about feeling anger, which is a natural thing, you know, but being overwhelmed by it, being more consumed by it, we lose perspective. You know, there's so much information. Like, if you think about the last time you were really, really, really angry at yourself, something you said, something you did, something you held back from saying or doing. It's not a time where you also think, you know what? I did 5 great things same morning. It's like, no, those are gone, you
it
know?
It consumes us, Sharon.
It consumes us.
And it destroys us from the inside out. That conversation that we have with ourselves is so toxic in those moments. And change never happens because of it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and again, it's so important to understand, and this is a distinction we try to make all the time. We feel what we feel. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not talking about putting down our feelings or being ashamed of them or trying to repress them. But is this what we really want to be enveloped by as the motivating force behind our actions? And just take a look. You know, what are the consequences of coming from that kind of place? It doesn't make us weak, truly, to develop more loving kindness.
I mean, I think it makes us incredibly strong. Mm-hmm. So as we go through periods in time, certain words come into the public domain. During the pandemic, I think one of those words was empathy. That was a word that we didn't really talk about much. I tend to spend a lot of time in corporate life, you know, as a coach and bringing meditation into corporations. So empathy was a big thing. But with empathy, we go into the rabbit hole with the person. And I see us coming out of this. And the first session that you're doing speaks to compassion, obviously one of the four immeasurables, as you just mentioned. And I would love for you to share more about the need for self-compassion as a way to make sure, like, as cliche as it sounds, like, our cup is at least half full so we can stay in it. We can stay in the type of change we wish to create in the world.
Yeah.
Can you share more about that?
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of levels to that as well. I mean, research is actually making a distinction between empathy and compassion, for example. Empathy being that kind of resonance, which is an essential building block to really caring. But sometimes we genuinely have a feeling of empathy, you know, for someone's situation. We're just frightened by what we see and we want to run away. Or sometimes we're so exhausted to begin with. It's like we can't muster the energy to respond and see if we can make a difference. And sometimes we get into that weird egotistical control thing, like, I am going to be the one to save, you know, everybody right away by Tuesday, you know, like whatever, which of course doesn't work. Or sometimes we have the compassionate response, which is moving toward what's happening, what we see, to see if we can be of help. Not to demand, you know, that we're in control, but to see if we can be of help. And so there are a lot of balances that are implied in that, including caring about ourselves as well as for others. And that's also very difficult for us, you know. Anytime I've used the term self-compassion, people usually equate it with laziness, you know, and not having standards of excellence or principles. And it doesn't mean that at all. But, you know, again, it's taking a realistic view, like, how do we sustain an effort? I mean, I can use the example of meditation, which writ large plays everywhere in our lives. You know, many meditation techniques involve having an object of awareness, and we rest our attention on that object, and then when our attention wanders, we try to let go of the distraction, whatever it is, and come back to that original object. So there I was in India, my very first retreat. The first meditation instruction I ever got was like that, which was around the feeling of the breath, the actual sensations of the in and out breath. So that was the first instruction, sit down and feel your breath. And I thought, that is so stupid. You know, I came all the way to India. Where's the magical, esoteric, fantastic technique that's going to wipe out all my suffering and make me a totally happy person? And then I thought, well, what's it going to be, like 800 breaths, 900 breaths before my mind wanders? And to my absolute shock, it was like one breath or sometimes two breaths, and I'd be gone, and I'd be way gone. And I kept hearing over and over again, don't worry about that. The important part is learning how to let go and start over. Let go and begin again. It's like repair or resilience. You know, don't worry about it. But I, of course, worried. And what do we usually do? You know, we sit down with some intention, like resting our attention on the feeling of the breath. Our minds wander, and we jump on this train of really harsh self-judgment. I can't believe I'm thinking again. No one else in the room is thinking. They're not thinking. They're sitting here in bliss. You're sitting here bathed in brilliant white light. I'm the only one who's thinking, I'm so stupid, I'm so bad. Plus my thoughts, they're so ridiculous. They're so banal. If they, these people were thinking, they'd be thinking beautiful thoughts. They'd be thinking loving thoughts. I'm the only one who's thinking again about, you know, that really, that traffic problem. I'm not the mayor. Why am I thinking about that? I'm so stupid, I'm so bad, right? So when we get lost in that, not only is it adding sometimes considerable amount of time to the distraction, we end up exhausted. We end up demoralized. It's so hard to have resilience. It's so hard to begin again. And the antidote to that is a quality of self-compassion. It doesn't mean you pretend nothing happened. You got distracted. But you know what? That's part of human nature. It's not just you. Give yourself a break. Start over. Start over with renewed determination. That works. The other doesn't work.
The other doesn't work, absolutely.
You know, so that's just a tiny little example from meditation, but we do that every day.
Every day.
In our lives.
Yeah, and we have a tendency sometimes, at least here in the West, we grab onto something, a just cause, and we put a lot of energy that is driven by several different emotions, if not tens and 20 different emotions. And it's a fast-burning rocket ship of whew, all this attention. The news media grabs onto it, adding more fuel to it. And then we go down the road a bit, 3 months, 6 months, even a year, and we wonder, what happened to that? We lose steam. We don't stay in it. And To your point, there's something, I think, around the ability to endure, the ability to be resilient, mm-hmm. self-compassion piece, that we burn out, maybe not through a classic definition, but we lose our mojo and we move on to something else. So we don't begin again on the just cause that we want to put some energy around. We go down this other pathway and we keep on going through this like roundabout with all these little branches, but we don't end up getting exactly where we want to get to. So, yeah, I love what you just...
Yeah, sometimes it's not a different definition of burnout. It's burnout.
Yeah, it's burnout. Yeah. So the second session, you get into equanimity, minus the total knee replacement version one. So, and I would love for you to share more about what people can expect from that session, because in real change, I know you just mentioned equanimity is balance. Some might use harmony, but I really love the image you shared with it being a gyroscope, because mm-hmm. I had one when I was growing up. I just loved it. Just that whole thing in motion.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what it represents. Like all this, all this stuff is coming to us. It's almost like Rumi's poem, The Guest House. Like, stand at the door laughing, welcome it all in, and you're there just spinning away. And I would love to for you to share more about how you think equanimity and wisdom will play into, like, how do we navigate this period of time that we're all sharing?
Well, I think, you know, we can also look at the things that detract from balance.
Sure.
You know, projection into the future.
Yeah.
Tremendous anxiety. Poles.
You know, all those poles.
Don't look at those poles.
All those poles. 97% of them are not correct, right?
Well, I was once interviewed by somebody about doom scrolling, and I said, sure, what is that? I didn't know what it meant. And he had explained it to me, and I said, oh, yeah, I do that. That's not a good habit. You know, balance means wisdom in this context. You know, you want to bring forth wisdom, and wisdom has a lot of manifestations. One is realizing you are not in control of the universe. In fact, I was once with a group of people, and I said, if only I were in control of the universe, I think it would be a lot better a world. And someone in the room challenged me. They said, are you sure? And I thought about it, and I said, I am really sure, you know, it would be a lot better. But guess what? It's not going to be that way. And it doesn't invite apathy. It invites some long vision, you know, like things take time sometimes. And sometimes you work, and it is planting a seed. You don't see immediate results, and you got to keep going. And it also implies a kind of balance where we can hold like a bigger picture of things, you know. And one of my favorite examples of equanimity was I was teaching in Parkland, Florida, pretty soon after the school shooting. Not immediately after, but, you know, within a year. To that community of people who had been affected by this shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. And this young woman raised her hand at one point, and she said she was not a student there. She'd been a student there at the same high school, but had already graduated. Her mother was a teacher there. And the whole community was very strongly affected, and she'd worked a lot with the students since, you know, the shooting. And she said, you know, I'm really having a strange experience being here, because it's really an incredible experience, you know, being together in this way, and the practice is so amazing. But I know the only reason it's happening is because that horrible thing happened. Mm. And I don't know how to get over that in order to appreciate this. And I said, you know, I don't know that we ever get over it, but we learn to hold them both at once.
Sure.
And in the Buddhist teaching, we call that equanimity. And sort of like the yin-yang symbol, sometimes in that light part, there's a circle of darkness. And in that dark part, there's a circle of light. And you learn to hold it all at once. And so then I saw her name, Samantha. I saw her again, you know, months later. And I said, oh, remember that conversation we had? And she said, not only do I remember it, I think about it every day of my life. She said, equanimity is now my North Star. That's what I try to guide my life by. And so I think of her, you know, often when the topic of equanimity comes up. And it's sort of like that. It's holding so much at once. And having a heart and mind big enough and spacious enough to experience the world that way. It's really a mysterious quality unless you explore it. You know, it sounds, again, so stupid, you know, but it's really very powerful.
No, it's really powerful. In 2022, I rode my bike across the country, and my wife drove the RV that we rented. And equanimity was a vital part of the trip, because we rode through some of the most rural places in the country. And you saw a lot of signage that really just spoke of hatred and divisiveness, darkness, if you will. And then you also met people in those same towns that were like-hearted. Not like-minded, but like-hearted. Mm-hmm. And it would have been really easy to be consumed by the signage that was focused on hatred and dividing and us versus them and all that jazz. So I had to find a way to also hold in my heart the goodness. And some of the goodness I didn't get to experience firsthand, but I just know that's there. Almost in a hopeful way to get across the country. And because I do believe that as a country, now I'm just speaking about the U.S., just we got so much goodness. You know, people want the best for each other. We might find different or have different ways of getting there based on how we grew up and just beliefs. But I do believe that people want the best for each other. We all have that fundamental desire to be safe and to be heard and to be seen and to be loved, you know. So that gets me to the third edition or third installment of your course or your series, and that's about resilience and hope. And as we round out here, Sharon, I would love for you to share what keeps you hopeful during this period of time, you know, because, you know, politics can be like flip-flopping in the wind like a flag sometimes. And one moment we're like, oh my God, like we're going to go to heck in a handbasket. And other times, like, we experience great joy and, you know, from both sides of the aisle, really.
Yeah.
What right now, what's keeping you hopeful?
I think there are a couple of things. One is very similar to what you were just talking about. Like when I was writing a book more recently than Real Change called Real Life. And I was studying awe, the quality of awe. And I'd only sort of known about the research, you know, where people go off like to the Redwood Forest and they look at the magnificent sequoia trees and they're filled with awe, that quality that really lifts us, you know, and inspires us. And to my amazement, as I looked more carefully at it, I thought it actually resembled what was true for me, which is that I mostly feel awe looking at the goodness of others. Yeah. You know, and they don't have to be famous people or and usually they're not celebrated people. They're people who are, you know, just doing their thing because it feels to them like the right thing to do, you know, to a neighbor, to even somebody who doesn't agree with them, you know, they're making sure they got some food or, you know, like, and there's so much of that. And I know that because I doom scroll, you know, I don't always open to that, you know, and I think so much of what we're talking about is sort of a conscious use of attention rather than just mechanical and habitual, you know, so I know I need to pay attention to that. I have to remind myself, I have to look for it because it's there. It's amazing, you know, and that gives me a lot of hope. It's just, you know, like, years ago, I was at a conference in San Francisco called the Peacemakers Conference, full of luminary speaking and, you know, the Dalai Lama and all kinds of people addressing the audience, and it was amazing. But my biggest takeaway from the whole conference was walking backstage and hearing the writer Alice Walker just talking to a group of people, and I overheard her say, as I get older, the thing that brings me the most happiness is like good-heartedness. And I just walked on by, you know, and out of all the talks and, you know, everything that happened there, which were amazing, that was the thing that resonated the most with me, you know, like, yeah, you know, I think that's really true. So that gives me a lot of hope. And then back to meditation practice, they say the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation specifically as an antidote to fear. And that, you know, my experience of that gives me a lot of hope because I see the strength in that. I see hatred, again, quoting the Buddha, you know, later echoed by Martin Luther King Jr. and so many others. The Buddha said, hatred will never cease by hatred. Hatred Absolutely. Will only cease by love. That is an eternal law. And I used to think that is quirky because here's the Buddha, who in so many ways was like Mr. Impermanence, you know, saying this is an eternal law. And I challenged it myself, you know, as well as seeing it challenged, I think, here too, like here, even here, you know. And I think it is really true. And knowing that this quality is not a weakness, that it can be cultivated, that's the other great controversy I find in the West, that we tend to think of loving kindness or compassion as limited. We got a dose and that's it. Rather than thinking, oh, this can be cultivated, this can be developed, but it can be. I've seen that again and again. I've certainly seen it in myself. And I do think it is the antidote to fear. And I think these things are available to us, and that gives me a lot of hope.
That's so great. I'll round us out here on a couple of different things. One story. It's a story I actually received this morning via email. Someone who attends our loving kindness practices on Friday. Neighbor spat, you know, fences, the whole thing. A lot of yelling back and forth. And I'm going to make the story a little bit shorter. So there's a lot going back, like painting on the fences, choice words, all of it. A lot of animus. And even one neighbor pointing cameras at the neighbor who sent me this note. Like sort of spying on them. And what the neighbor who sent me the email did, they created these big posters. And on the poster, it was like, may you be safe, may you be healthy, you know, the loving kindness mantras. And they put them up in their backyard. So the cameras that were directed at their house, that's what the cameras picked up. And as soon as that happened, the intensity, the anger, got flushed out of the system. And for the first time in, say, 6 months, the neighbors had a civil conversation about their boundary, if you will. So this stuff works. Yeah. this stuff puts a powerful ripple into the world. How do people find your series around the election? Can you point them to the right place to sign up and participate and put a good ripple into the world?
Yeah, thank you. It's just on my website, which is SharonSalzberg.com. You have to make sure it's spelled Salzberg with an E, not a U, which spells like I was going to try to change it to. But it's just there, and it's in a sliding scale, you know, for fee, including if you can't pay anything, that's fine, you know. So.
Well, I'll encourage everyone listening to sign up and to participate. And if you can't make a particular session, from what I know you have the recording, and the recording will be shared. So there's no reason why people shouldn't sign up. So I encourage people to sign up. And Sharon, as I started, I just want to thank you for the ripple that you put into the world back in 69 and the early 70s, and how that ripple has carried forward and touched so many lives, including this life who is speaking right now. I would not be here in the same way without your work. And again, we never knew each other up until this point, you know, and so I know that I'm not alone. There's certainly a ton of people that you know you've rippled into, and there's millions of people that you have yet to meet on behalf of all of them, I want to thank you for all the love and kindness you've put into the world.
Well, thank you, and thank you for all your work.
We try day by day, breath by breath. So thanks for joining me, Sharon.
What a special conversation to sit with one of my teachers. I hope you enjoyed what Sharon shared with you. And I hope you'll join her for her election series. I'll be there. So you know at least someone who's going to it. Sharon brings so much wisdom, not only to meditation and mindfulness, but to life. After all, we practice meditation not to get good at meditation, but to get better at life. I'll put all the different ways you can follow Sharon and connect with her. And if you do, please tell her you heard about her from the Kintsugi podcast. Sharon, thank you for putting the type of ripple you're putting into the world. The world definitely needs more loving kindness. And to you, thank you as well. A huge thank you, because I know time is your most precious resource. We can't make any more of it. So the fact that you spent some of your time here with us on the Kintsugi podcast means the world to me. So again, thank you. And if you haven't yet left a kind review or rating wherever you happen to listen to Kintsugi, I hope you'll do that today, because your rating and review helps others find our Kintsugi spirit. And if you want to connect further with our community, you can download Pause, Breathe, Reflect from Apple's App Store or Google Play and join our community of like-heartedness. And if you ever want to speak one-on-one about how you and your team can prevent a bad moment from turning into a bad day or building more resilience, I'll put the calendar link to my calendar in the show notes as well. Again, thanks for being here. And remember, if you have a challenging moment through this election cycle, remember to come back to your breath. Remember your practice. And know that you've got this and we've got you. And don't forget to vote, because your vote puts a beautiful ripple into the world. And until next week, let's celebrate our scars as golden symbols of our strength and resilience. I love you. And I'll see you next week. This episode is brought to you by Pause, Breathe, Reflect, the app that can help bring more mindfulness to your everyday moments. Imagine what would be possible if more people could live more mindfully.